we are holding on Membeza Morales, finally, Fora. Mishnah says, Hamaskid Moise Tochavere, a person deposits money for safekeeping by another person. Sroron, that person bundled it up in his sudur, for example, Rashi says, so like in his turban or whatever, and he slung it behind him, as opposed to in front of him, as the Gemara will say, which is the right way to do it.
Why would he throw it in front of him?
Because in front of him is where you can actually watch over it, and back of you is a little bit careless.
Back, I understand.
That's the point.
You want to be on your shoulders to the back, but why would you throw it in front of you?
The point is, you're supposed to carry it in front of you, as we will see in the Gemara.
So you carry it.
So what? Well, right. Okay. The point is, you tied it up in your turban or whatever, and now you flung it behind you. That's carelessness. That's pshia because that's not the proper way to guard it. Okay. Or you gave his money to his young son or daughter below bar bas mitzvah. We looked about this the other day. Rashi learns that it's or he locked the door in front of them, or he locked the money in a box or whatever, but didn't lock it up properly, so it's possible for the kids, let's say, to get in there. Most other Rishonim learn that Benal Bafnaim is a continuation. Improperly, right? He didn't lock it up properly. Most other Rishonim explain that Benal, as we learned the other day, that Benal Bafnaim Shalai Karoi is actually a continuation of the case with Benal Bitte Akhtanim. I have that backwards. Actually, Rashi is the one who learns that that's one long case that he gave it to his son and daughter, but then didn't lock the door of the house properly, so they were able to get out and then lose it. Whereas
we had it a few days ago.
Yeah, most other Rishonim learn that it's two different cases. Oy no, b'fneim shalei karoy, that he gave it to his children, or another possibility, he put it in a box in a safe or whatever, but didn't lock it properly. In all these cases, chayev shalei shama k'shalei shima k'derech hashomrim. He's chayev for anything that happens to it, because he's pesheh. He didn't guard it in the way that a shomer is supposed to guard it.
It's not called shmira.
Well, it's called. It's a very low level of shmira, though. It's not enough.
Shmira kusa,
but it's not even. I mean, shmira kusa we talked about in connection with a shorah muad or whatever, but if he guarded it in the way that Shomrim usually watch the thing, potter, then he would be potter for what happens to it.
Which means if that's the usual derech,
if the potter. Right. Well, we'll talk about in the Gemara as far as the usual derech, as far as money. We're going to get into that in the Gemara. But yeah, the Rambam writes that in general, with various kinds of things, you have, for the Rambam gives examples. Let's say beams, the normal way of guarding them is you put them in your gatehouse, you know, the little structure that you have in front of the gate to your chatzar. So you put somebody else's beams there, that's good enough. That's a good enough shemira, whereas it's more expensive stuff. You have to keep it in your chatzar or in your house or bury it, as we'll see in the Gemara. So the Gemara asks, "Bishleim akulu shalei shima kader hashomrim." Hello. Okay, I can understand why most of the cases in the Mishnah you chayev because you didn't guard it in the normal way. You left it to your young son and daughter. They don't have das to watch over it. You locked the door improperly, as according to Rashi, that therefore, in other words, they were able to get out and lose the money. Or according to everybody else, you didn't lock the safe properly or whatever. Fine, we can understand why you chayev in those cases. But if we're saying if you bundled up the money and slung it behind you, what's the problem? I have a little mabit. What more should he have done? He bundled it up after all. The answer is Amar Rava. Because Amar Rava, Amar Rabbi Yitzchok. No, because Amakra, you have the pasuk that says in connection with Ma'isa Sheni, the context is Ma'isa Sheni, that it describes how you exchange Ma'isa Sheni fruit or produce or whatever for cash. You take the cash to your shalayim and spend it over there. We'll learn a great deal about this.
Right on your back.
No. The pasuk says v'tzarta kesef biyodecha. The pasuk says you should bundle up the money in your hand, which implies after we should throw it in, even if it's bundled up, which is a good level of shmira, giyu biyadecha, they still have to be in your hand, not literally in your hand, let's say, but in other words, they have to be in front of you, so you can keep an eye on it.
But sarta,
in other words, you need both. Mepharshim say the point is you need both. You need it to be bundled up.
Not only bundled up,
but it has to be in your hand, or at least, in other words, closely. Yeah, closely available. For example, the Rambam says, you know, you put it in front of you and on your stomach, like in a fanny pack or whatever, that sort of thing. So after we should throw in your
badecha.
The Rambam mentions that idea of putting it al bitnoi, the Rambam says, yeah, which literally means on his stomach. Yeah, like something like a fanny pack or whatever. Okay, the point is, therefore, in our Mishnah, he slung it behind him. Okay.
A backwards worn fanny pack.
Whatever, new, whatever you want to call it, fine. Okay, new. Okay, whatever it is, the point is, therefore, an armed Mishnah, when he slung it behind him, that's considered Pshia. That's not being careful with it. Okay. So now the Gemara is going to digress a little bit to talk about a little more about how a person should handle his money. In general, a person should have his money easily available to him. For example, Rashi says, don't be masking it to other people, because let's say there's something immediately available to buy and make a profit on. You want your money to be liquid so you can get to it right away. As the pasuk says, you should bundle up your money in your hand, implying that it should always be in your hand, it should always be easily available to you.
But we said that money should be varied.
That's what we're going to get to. That's what we're talking about. That's what we're talking about. The kodin. You were talking about your own money. The Iyun Yaakov, by the way, and Yaakov says another reason, besides that Rashi's saying if you have a good investment opportunity comes up all of a sudden, the Iyun Yaakov gives another reason. If tzedakah comes up, you should be able to give it right away on the spot. Okay. But Amr Rabbi Yitzchak, also Rabbi Yitzchak
said,
no, not all his money, because that's the next thing. But Amr Rabbi Yitzchak, lo'olam yashlish adam es ma'osav, a person should always divide his money into thirds. Shlish b'karka, one-third in land, which Maharsha says there's two possibilities what it means. Either it means buried in the ground, as we're going to talk about soon, or it means invested in land.
Bikarka
can mean in the ground, or it can mean invested in land. Or shlish b'prakmatia, one third invested in goods in trade goods for sale, in investments basically. Or shlish tachas yada, and one third readily available. Okay. And Maharsha points out each of these three has an advantage. No, we're talking about the household money. No, we're not talking about small amounts that you have for little expenses. We're talking about the bulk of his money. Financial portfolio, right. Yeah. The investment, yeah. As a matter of fact, I read an interesting thing. Back in the early 70s, there was a financial crisis in America and in some other countries because of monetary policy or whatever. A bunch of people, the monetary policy changed at that time, whatever. Yeah, no, well, this is before stagflation, but whatever. They went off the Bretton Woods system, whatever, you know, you can...
That was
in the early 70s. So a lot of people... 71, actually, this is.
71.
Okay. So, but a lot of younger life who had a lot of younger life had invested in currency futures, and now they lost their shirts. Sort of, they say that Moshe gave a shiur in his yeshiva, pointing out this Gemara and saying, you know what, when the Chachamim tell you what the good investment advice is, don't have all your eggs in one basket, diversify. The Chachamim knew what they were talking about, and you need to listen to that.
What means good?
Prakmati means good, yeah.
Commodities,
whatever, yeah. So Maharsha points out each of these things has an advantage over the other. Karka has an advantage that it's never lost. It's always there. Prakmatya has an advantage that you can earn a fortune from it. And Tachas Yodeh has the advantage that you have it readily available. Okay. Also talking about money management, Rabbi Yitzchak said, a bracha is only found in something which is hidden from the eye. As it says, Hashem will command the bracha to be with you. The simple meaning of asamecha means something like your storehouses, but we're darshining it meloshin samui, meloshin hidden. So the Eibishter will command the bracha to be in your hidden things. Tanur d'Eibishter. Well, in other words, exactly what it sounds like. The davar asamui min ayin, something that's hidden from the eye.
Yeah, but what is it?
Okay, so there's a couple of things. First of all, one idea is if it's not hidden from the eye, there's the idea that an ayin hara can have an effect on it. That's one idea. The other idea is, in general, most of the time, usually we know the Eibishter, when the Eibishter does a nest, usually the Eibishter prefers that it should be melubish b'dakei ateva. So if you have something which is hidden from the eye, meaning you don't know exactly how much there is, for example, so to speak, it's easier for the Eibishter to do a nest with it and increase it. But if it's publicly known how much it is, then to increase it would be going beyond the usual rules of nature, and the Eibishter doesn't usually do that.
So if you bury your money, you might come dig it up and find there's $1 million there.
Okay, so wait. So let's learn what Rabbi Shmuel
concealed from the eye.
Well, but wait. Let's learn what Rabbi Shmuel says, and then we'll talk about. Tanur d'Rabbi Shmuel. Rabbi Shmuel, in the yeshiva of Rabbi Shmuel, they taught a braisa. Ein a bracha mitzuya ela b'davar she'ein ayin shelatis bo. A bracha is only commonly found in something which the eye has no control over. Shenemi yitzav Hashem yitzcha es a bracha b'asamecha. So here he's not darshaning b'asamecha meloshet samoi, but rather just the simple meaning. B'asamecha means your storehouses, implying something which is stored versus hidden away. So is there any actual difference between what Rabbi Yitzchak is saying and what Rabbi Shmuel is saying? Maharsha says no, there's no actual difference between them. They're just arguing how to darshan the word basamecha. Various other Mephoshim talk about there may be differences. For example, there could be a difference between something which you know, there could be something, for example, you know that you know that it exists, for example, versus you know how much it exists. So that could be. One of them would be saying a bracha can still be chal on it, and then it'll increase more than you expected, because you know, even though you know it's there, you don't know how much there is. Whereas Rabbi Shmuel would be saying only if it's the davar she'ein ayin shelatos, where the eye has no control over it at all, like you don't even know it exists, kind of. So there's that. They talk about the possibilities that maybe the other way around. What if you have, for example, stored bits and pieces of it in different places? It's ayin ayin shelatos, because the eye can't see it all at once, but it's not somim and ayin, because you know in each individual cache how much there is. Okay. But that's the basic idea, is that either it's a matter of ayin hara, or it's a matter of that the Eibishter usually does a net only when it's melubish b'dakei ateva, and therefore if you know how much there is, then you can't necessarily then it would be a net, it would be an open net for it to increase more than you expected, and the Eibishter usually doesn't do that, and if he does, then you lose his chosid for it. Turn it up.
An example of what really it means that.
Well,
Well,
now we're going to have an example. Turn it up on. And ha'holach lomodus gorno. If somebody is going to measure out the amount of grain or whatever it is that's in his silo, before he on his way to go measure, he says yihirotin melchanach Hashem alakenu shetishlach bracha b'matzi adenu. It should be your will, Hashem, to send a bracha in the work of our hands. His chalomud, when he first starts the measuring, Omer, he says, Baruch HaShalech Bracha B'Kriyazeh. He says, blessed is Hashem who sends a bracha in this pile of grain. And actually, this Gemara is also in Tainus. Rashi over there in Tainus says this means a full-fledged bracha B'Shem Malchus. Baruch HaTa Hashem Elokeinu Melech HaOlam HaShalech Bracha. Wait. Modad V'Achakach Berach. If he measures and then makes the bracha, HaRez the Tfilah Shav. Then it's a useless tefillah. Because then, after measuring it, the bracha is not going to be chal. L'fisha ena bracha metzuya, loy b'davar ha-shoko, loy b'davar ha-modud, loy b'davar ha-monuri. Because a bracha is not commonly found in something that's weighed, or measured, or counted. Elo b'davar ha-somim in ayin, only in something that's hidden from the eye. Shenemi yitzav ha-shem yitzachas bracha ba-samecha. So that's the thing. If you make the bracha before the measuring, fine. You can expect that then it means that there'll be now more than you expected there to be, because you didn't know how much there was. It was somim in ayin up until this point.
Why did Hashem count the Bnei Yisrael?
It makes us a davar shebeminyan, which is a bottle. And besides, which
also say the same thing here.
Because the Eibishter himself is able to override us and give us a bracha. Yosef Hashem Elohim Kachem Elohim. We're talking about when you count something. When you count something, you make it subject to an ayin hara, or you make it that now you know how much there is, and therefore it would be a nes goli for it to increase more than necessary. But the Eibishter himself is able to override that when it comes to the Jewish people. Okay. What are we talking about, b'chlal, this business of making a bracha when you're measuring your pile of grain? Many poskim say that this specifically only applies, at least the part about saying it, b'shem ha-malchus, if you're measuring it for the purpose of taking truma and ma'aser. Then you're making a bracha, for one thing, because there's a famous thing that the Eibishter promises, out of all the mitzvahs, we know you're not allowed to test the Eibishter, that I'll do this mitzvah only if you cause such and such to happen, except by ma'aser. You're allowed to say, I'm going to give ma'aser, and I expect the Eibishter to make me wealthy because of it. And some posts can say it applies more generally to tzedakah. So therefore, if you're measuring your pile of grain for the sake of taking truma and ma'aser, which you have to necessarily, because ma'aser at least has to be given in a precise amount, then you're entitled to make a bracha and expect that
it's just the grain.
That's truma.
Truma.
Ma'aser rishon has to be full 10% of what's left after you take truma. Ma'aser sheni has to be full 10% of what's left after you take ma'aser rishon. Ma'aser oni, same thing. So those have to be measured out precisely.
So the three ma'aseris is 10% of what's left.
You never have more than two ma'asers in a given year. It's either ma'aser rishon and ma'aser sheni, or ma'aser rishon and ma'aser oni. But yeah, either one is 10% of what's left. Yeah. So it has to be measured precisely. So that's the point, actually. Some of the Mephoshim say the vort is, because given that if you measure it, you're going to remove the chance for the bracha that we just said, therefore you're entitled to, before you start measuring, ask the Eibishter, undo the effect of that. It's true I'm measuring it, but I'm doing it only in order to do your mitzvah, taking ma'aser. Therefore, make sure that doesn't affect the ability for it to grow more than I expect, which is the bracha that you're supposed to get for taking ma'aser anyway. Asher shetis asher. Yeah. So there's that. Interesting vort also that one of the Balei HaMusar of Chaim Shmulevitz says on this in one of his things, in general, you're not supposed to ask for a nest to happen to you. As a matter of fact, there was actually a bit of discussion in Poskim, you know, when it comes to Hanukkah and Purim, we're supposed to say Al-Nisim in benching, and if we don't, then towards the end we say Harachmon, Huyasalon, Nisim, Kamosha, Asalav, Etzenu, etc. A number of Achronim talk about, since when do we ask the Ebershter to do Nisim for us? So they say, okay, maybe there's a difference between a nest for the Klal versus a nest for the Prat or whatever, but what are we saying over here? Basically, you're asking for a nest. The answer is, he says that that would be a nest if you had more than you expected. He says, Faket, before you measured it, means it's not a nest, it's not together nest that it will increase. It's together, there's no, the Iker is not the fact that there's a measurement over here, the Iker is the Ebershter's Bracha. Therefore, the Ebershter's Bracha can just as well make it more as less. That's not considered a nest. If after you were to measure it, you were to ask for to increase, that would be asking for a nest, and that's what the Gemara is saying, you can't do it, Tefillah Shrub. But the important thing to know is it's not the derech hateva that you brought X amount in, and that's how much you expect to have. Until you measure it, you have a right to expect that the Ebershter can just as well make it more, that the Ebershter can just as well make it more as make it the amount that you brought in.
Watch what's on your bank account.
Your bank account, you know how much there is, so that's Dover Amadur, that's not necessarily the same thing. Okay. Onward. Okay, getting back to this matter of watching money, Omar Shmuel, Ksafim Elohim Shmira Ela Bekarka. When it comes to money, the only valid way to guard it is by burying it in the ground. They say, by the way, and I've voted to convert on this, it's brought in a number of Sifri Chsidus that I've also brought it a couple of times in Sichus, that the deeper idea of it is the way to, if you have kesef, if you have a little money, the way to avoid that it has a negative effect on you is bakarka, make sure of an apshin karka lakotia, that you have the feeling that you yourself are like dust. That'll preserve it.
So why do we say carried is in his hand?
Okay.
What saying is in
okay. Karka. Okay. So one explanation is that the Mishnah is talking about when he gave it to you and you're bringing it home, you first bring it home. Then you have to bundle it up and carry it in front of you. Once you bring it home, you're expected to bury it.
Didn't we say a man should always have money on himself?
We're talking about somebody else's karka, somebody else's money. After the only valid way to keep it is in the karka. However, Rava says, Shmuel will agree that there's a case where you don't have to bury it in the ground, namely if it's Erev Shabbos, Bein HaShemoshes, well, not literally Bein HaShemoshes, because of course you can't do Malacha then, but we mean late in the afternoon on Friday, that Rabbanan would not be Matriach him to go to the trouble of digging a hole right then and bury it. He can wait till after Shabbos. What we mean by Bein HaShemoshes, by the way, the order is showing him, I think the Mordechai says it can mean any time, even from Erev Shabbos, Chatzos, because after that already you're not really supposed to be doing malacha that doesn't directly have to do with Shabbos. The isha, however, then if he got it on Friday, so fine, he didn't bury it because we weren't matriachim, but then he waited on Matzah Shabbos enough time that he could have buried him, v'loy kavrinu, and he didn't bury it, then at that point he'll be chayev for anything that happens.
So he has to bury it.
Yeah. Havdalah, we're going to talk about now. However, if he is Tamad Chacham, who the he is, let's talk about in a minute after we learn the line, Savar, then he can wait. Dilma Mibayla Zuzila Abdalta, because he can think maybe he needs money for Havdalah. So what does this mean? Rashi explains it means like this. If the Maskid, the owner of the money who deposited it for safekeeping, if he is a Tamad Chacham, then the Shomer is not obligated to bury it right after Shabbos. Because he may figure, you know what, this Maskid, the owner of the money, is a Tamar Chacham, he's particularly careful about Havdalah, he's not just Yotze with Atochan Antonu, he's not Yotze from somebody else, he's not Yotze different Beforshim, talk about what's that, I mean, everybody's Chayiv and Havdalah, but they talk about different possibilities, maybe only Tamar Chachamim are careful to make it themselves, maybe only Tamar Chachamim are careful to make it on wine as opposed to beer or what have you, whatever it is. If the Maskid, the Tamar Chacham, the Nifkad, the Shomer, has the right to assume, you know what, he may need it now, Matzah Shabbos, because he needs some of that money for Havdalah. Therefore, I will wait to bury it until I know that he's not going to need it for Havdalah anymore. Which, therefore, they talk about, does that mean already until he has till Sunday? No, does that mean maybe till Sunday, he has till Sunday morning, maybe? Or does it mean maybe he only has some amount of time after Shabbos? Whatever, that's one explanation. Then there's a couple of other explanations among Rishonim. One of them is that, yes, we are talking about that a couple of other possibilities are that we're talking about not the Maskid as a Tamar Chacham, but rather the Shomer as a Tamar Chacham. In which case, there's a couple of possibilities. He himself may say, I'm going to borrow some of this money that I need for Havdalah, and then I'll pay it back afterwards, which would be normally you're not supposed to do that, but in this case, that's a valid thing. That's a valid possibility. No, you wouldn't be considered shaleach yad because we would assume that the owner doesn't mind that he does a mitzvah with his money as long as he's going to get fully reimbursed. Or yet another possibility is it means that the shomer is a tamar chacham, but not that he needs money for havdalah, but rather you can't expect him to do malacha before havdalah. So you can't expect him to go bury it before he himself. So that's yet another. So there's a few different possibilities. Yeah. So either way, according to these various possibilities, it would mean that's an acceptable reason to not have it buried.
Okay. He would be chayav or not?
No, then he'd be potter. Then if it was stolen during that time before he had a chance to bury it, according to
Shemayim, it's really up to halacha.
That's what we're saying. Okay. Tosfos, by the way, has a long discussion over here, and a bunch of other Rishonim get into the discussion also. Is all this talking only about a shomer chinam? What about a shomer sachar? A shomer sachar, we say, is chayav for gneva. Does that mean even if he buried it in the ground, he's still chayav? Or maybe not. Maybe if he buried it deeply enough in the ground, he'd be potter. So Tosfos goes back and forth on it and tries to say that maybe not, maybe indeed if he buried it properly, even a shomer sachar would be potter, would be considered an onus. But there's a lot of other Rishonim get into it also. They talk about the Rambam, the Rashba, other Rishonim talk about it, that maybe even if he buried it, he'll always be chayev. If Gneva is Gneva, maybe the only way he'd be potter is, for example, if he himself became sick. Or maybe even not. Maybe even if he himself became sick, he'd still be chayev. The only way he'd be potter would be if there was actual list of mezuyah and somebody held him up at gunpoint or whatever.
If he buries it and does, what happens?
Then his Yorshim have to find it. Then he has to inform his Yorshim but he has to inform them before he dies, especially if he's a Shomer Sachar. Then
You don't know how much money it is if they dig up the whole backyard and
All right. Onward. No, I mean, if he didn't tell them, then okay, the market is going to be entitled to take them to Beis Din, and Next, now, all of this that we're talking about burying it in the ground, the Gemara says, that was all in Shmuel's times. It was safe to bury it in the ground. And by the way, that's another answer between the Mishnah. The Gemara is going to go on to say that in different times, different circumstances, one other answer is the Mishnah may have been talking about before thieves were that common. It was good enough to put it in a box. No, this is long after. This is hundreds of years. Yeah, this is long after. Still, the Mishnah might have been talking about when conditions were safer. It was good enough to lock them, let's say, in a safe in your house, in a box or whatever in your house. By Shmuel's times, that wasn't safe anymore, and you had to bury it in the ground. That's another answer. Next, but nowadays that there are gishushoi, people who tap the ground and are able to detect by the sound, by the different sound, whether there's a hollow over there. Then it's not safe to bury it in the ground anymore. Ein lahem shmira ela b'shmei kodesh. Then the only valid way to keep money is by putting it in the roof beams. However, time went on. There's this arms race between the ganavim and the honest people. Nowadays, you have people who break through the roofs. Ein lahem shmira ela b'nei urbi. Then the only valid way is between the rows of bricks. Now, what we mean by the rows of bricks, by the way, is what we mean is like this. A common way of making walls, we'll learn at the beginning of Baba Basra in a couple of months, that's the Shem, is a common way of building walls is they'd have a row of bricks, a row of half bricks, and cement between them to make a thick wall. So according to this, then the only valid way would be to hollow out over there that area, that cement between the two courses of the wall, and stick it in there. Okay. Amar Rava. However, Rava says, Shmuel agrees that it's good enough to put it in the wall, meaning you don't actually literally have to put it in between the two columns of bricks over there. It's good enough if you remove some of the mortar between the rows of bricks, let's say, and put it in over there. Okay. Inami ben Akronos, okay, Marshall takes that out. However, time passed, and none of them have gotten smarter. So now you have people who know how to tap the walls, and again, to listen out for hollows or whatever. Then the only valid way to guard it is by putting it in the tefach nearest of the wall, nearest to the ground, or the tefach of the wall nearest to the ceiling. Because then they won't think of looking there. They'll think to look in the middle of the wall. Could also be that then they won't be able to tap so easily and be able to tell that there'll be any difference. Yeah,
because it's reported.
Because
the sounds are different.
So the sounds will be different, yeah. Now, many Rishonim say that actually not necessarily is all of this permanent halacha for all time. It depends on condition. Now, you know, in later times, you didn't necessarily, the Ganovim lost these techniques. So then you're back to, you can bury it in the karka, and that's good enough, for example.
Now it's,
Reb Moshe Feinstein talks about that nowadays, the safest place to put it is in the bank, especially with deposit insurance and all that. So then that's exactly what you have to do. That's a valid shmira for money. If somebody is masked money by you, is put it in the bank. Let's talk about another possibility. You're talking about going back to the idea of burying it in the ground. How deep do you need to bury it? Now, Chosam Tnan, now we learn in a Mishnah in Pesachim, Chometz Shenokla Ala Mapolos, if you have Chometz that a wall collapsed on it, Harehu Kumavur, that's considered as if it was destroyed. You don't have to go dig up the rubble in order to find the Chometz and burn it. Reb Shimon Gamliel, I'm a kol shein akel of yachol l'chapasachar. Reb Shimon Gamliel says it depends how deeply it's buried. It has to be deep enough that a dog would not be able to search it out. And v'tana, and we learn in a braita, kama chafisas akel of gimel tfachim. How deep can a dog dig for it? It would be three tfachim. So now the question is, hachamai, what about over here? What about over here? Do you also need to bury it that deep? Mi be'in in shlosha tfachim olai. Do you need, when we say you have to bury the money in the ground before all these... how deep in the ground?
Right.
Yes. Amalei, so Rav Ashi answers, no, the difference is like this. Hasam Mishum Recha. The difference is over there, you need it to be deep enough that the dog is not going to be able to sniff it out. Therefore, in Gimel Tzvachim, therefore it has to be three Tzvachim deep, because dogs have a good sense of smell.
No.
Hacha, but over here, Mishum Echsturi Me'ena. Here it's just a matter of you want it to be hidden from sight.
Right.
Therefore, Loi Be'in and Gimel Tzvachim. So you don't need it to be quite as deep as three Tzvachim. Hey, but Kama, how deep does it have to be? Amarachra Mesichra needs to be Tefach. One Tefach, that's enough.
So if he cannot be seen, he can bring his dog and ask him to smell.
A dog can't smell money.
A dog can smell things under the earth, yeah.
Fine, but it's not going to be able to smell coins. I should mention, by the way, also, I forgot to mention a number of Rishonim, the Rosh and others, talk about that maybe all of this is only talking about things like money, because for one thing, it's easily portable, and because it's easily portable and easily fungible, once money on one coin is just like another coin, therefore, ganavim amur moser nefesh on it. Not necessarily are we talking about other kinds of valuables. Maybe the rules for guarding them are not quite as strict, because a ganav is going to be afraid to take them, maybe, because he can't so easily fence them.
That's right.
Let's say, well, so the Rambam does extend it to other kind of valuables. The Rambam says any kind of valuables that can be buried in the ground without them deteriorating, for example, let's say a bar of gold or whatever, same thing. You have to bury them in the ground, and otherwise you haven't done proper shmirah. But the other Rishonim talk about there's still maybe a difference. Coins is something you can easily, once a ganav steals them, that's it. There's no way of knowing these could be the very same coins or whatever, as opposed to, let's say, it was a silver keli or whatever, or a gold keli or whatever, that maybe not, because a ganav may not be able to get to dispose of it that easily. Okay. So you have to bury it a tefach.
And a diamond?
According to, I guess it would depend on the smachlokas. I mean, a diamond is also something that's easily fenceable. I guess it's not really easily traceable.
No.
And nowadays, I guess they have technology too, but I don't know. You know,
very hard.
Okay. All right. Onward. Okay. Now now the Gemara is going to talk about a couple of cases, Taka, involving guarding of money, and cases where cases of various things that happen. Hahu gavra da'afkid zuzeh gavichavri. There was a person who was masked money by somebody else. That person put the money in a hunter's hut. We talked about this case briefly the other day. So this is Rashi describes it's a little hut. It's a little hat-shaped hut made to go hunt birds. You go and you hide out in there like a duck blind when you're hunting birds. So he put the money in there. Ignore, and it got stolen. Now it is true, Rabbi Yosef says, this would have been a valid guarding from the point of view of Ganovim, because you don't usually expect Ganovim themselves don't expect that money is going to be found in a Srifa Durbani. Therefore it would have been very good. It's not necessary to say you had to bury it in order to make it safe from Ganovim. This would have been a pretty good safe place. Wait, no, birds aren't going to take money. It's too heavy for them. Come on. However, when it comes to fire, it's pshia, because if a fire had broken out, it would have been burnt. And therefore, have a tchilos of pshia, a sefer ba'onas chayav. In this case, then, it's one of those cases where the original thing was pshia. In the end, it turned out to be an onas, because ganavim unexpectedly stole it. Nevertheless, you chayav, because you started out with pshia. Tosfos points out that
Shia followed by onus.
Well, wait, that's one opinion. The Gemara is going to bring another opinion now in a second. But Tosfos points out, even according to the opinion that says it's chayev, there does have to be some causal connection between the pshia and the onus. We learned the other day, for example, that if you let the animal go out to the meadow and it died, we learned over there that Rava would say, that Rava said, malachamavis malihacha malihachim. It would have died just as well if it was at home. There's no link between the pshia and the onus. But here there's a link between the pshia and, here there is a certain link between the pshia and the onus. Because the fact of the matter is the ganovim did find it over there.
After there was
even though you'd think it was safe from ganovim, but it wasn't safe from fire, and in the end the ganovim taka found it. Ikadamri, or another version is no, that Rabbi Yosef said the other way around. It is true that from the point of view of that it might have been burnt, it is pshia, because this is a place that's easily flammable. But when it comes to ganovim, it is a valid place to store it, because you don't expect ganovim to find it over there. Therefore, according to this second version, if you had, you started out with pshia, and it turned out it was lost because of onus, you would be potter. The bottom line halacha is like the first version. And therefore, in this case, he is indeed chayev for having put it in place. That's the halacha. Yeah. Another case.
As long as
there's a certain connection between them. Yeah. Another case. Hahu gavra dafkid zuzay gavri chavre. A person was masking money by another person. Later on, amalei habli zuzay. Later on, he says, "Give me my money." Amalei, and the person says, "Lo yadayna hecha isvinu." I don't know where I put him. Also, lekamei the Rava, that came to Rava. Amalei told him, as we had last week, "Kol lo yadayna pshia osihi." Whenever you say, "I don't know," it's considered pshia. Zil shalim, go pay it. Now, it's not so simple, actually. The Meiri actually talks about there may be a difference. If the person said, the Meiri brings two possibilities. One is that maybe he's only chayev if he's not even sure if he put it in a safe place. If he's sure he put it in a safe place, he just can't remember where that place is, maybe he wouldn't be chayev. At least we would give him time to find where that place is. That's one possibility. And then the Meiri says, maybe not, on the other hand. Even if he put it in a safe place, the fact that he so completely forgot about it is still pshia. One thing is, by the way, they talk about, I mean, we had a similar thing last week. We had on Lamed Hayam and Aleph, we had a case like that involving Rav Nachman. Why is the Gemara repeating it?
Right.
One difference is, because here we just talk about chilas of pshia versus the onus. In that case over there was no onus in the end. The money was by him all along. He couldn't find it at first, and later on, he found it after his mansion had been taken away from him. The case over here might be that later on it was stolen. So it's chilasav of shia v'seif of onus. It started out being a fesheya by being careless. It ended up being an onus because it was stolen. And Rava is telling him, on the basis of what we just said, that he's chayav. Another case. Hahu gavra da'afkid zuzi gavra chavre. A person was masked money by another person. Ashleminu le'ime. This shomer gave the money to his mother to watch for him. Vo'isvinu b'kartalisa. She put the money in a box. Ve'ignu when it was stolen. Omar Rava heichen dainu dainu l'hayijina. So Rava says, how should the Dayanim judge this case? Who should we say is Chayev, or should we say that they're Potter? Namely, Lididei Zil Shlim, should we tell the original Shomer you have to pay because Shomer Shemosel or Shomer Chayev, as we had the other day, the whole sugya about it, you're the original Shomer, you have no right to give it to another Shomer. Oh no, he can answer that. Why not? Kol HaMafkid Adas Ishtir Bono Hu Mafkid, as we learned there. That when you masked something with somebody else, it's almanas, it's aldas, that he can feel free to give it to his wife or his older children, or in this case his mother, anybody else in his household is a bendas. So my mother is equally well a bendas as I am, is equally well a basdas as I am. I'm entitled to give it to her. That's not considered shomer shemosel shomer. And here's, by the way, where Tosfos talks about, which we mentioned the other day, that Tosfos says, true, you'll be potter in that sense, in the sense that the owner can't say, you know what, I don't trust the other person, I don't trust your mother's shavua, therefore you have to pay. So in that sense, not. However, Tosfos says, let's say, for example, the mother didn't have what
That's
to pay. We talked about it over there. Tosfos mentions it over here. That, let's say, for example, the mother didn't have what to pay, then after all, the shomer is going to be chayev.
She didn't have what to pay.
Let's say she doesn't have any money to pay. Let's say in this case it turned out that she was chayev. In this case, we're going to say it turns out she's potter for reasons which the Gemara will continue in a second. Let's say the scenario had been that she's chayev. Let's say she had been pesheya. Then, and let's say she didn't have money to pay. Then it would, then Tosfos says, Rabbeinu Tam says it would fall back on him. Because he's fine. You're potter. If you're potter in the sense that we can't say that you're the owner can say your mother, I don't want to deal with your mother, I'm dealing with you. But if she doesn't have what to pay, then you're going to have to pay after all. Many other Rishonim disagree with, including the Rambam, disagree with that and say that no, when it says kol hamafkid al das ishto yibonav hamafkid, it means exactly what it sounds like. It's fully at face value. Not only it means you have the right to give it, in this case, to your mother, but if the mother doesn't have what to pay, you, the Shomer HaPater, you gave it over to another mendas. That then das is now the one who has responsibility. She doesn't have what to pay, fine, the choy will be on her until she can pay. You, the son, are not going to be chayav.
Even you knew that she didn't have the money?
Yeah. Okay. Onward. So Rava continues, okay, should we tell the mother you should pay? Because you didn't bury it. You put it in a box. And Umra, she can answer, why should I have to pay? Loyamali Labdi De Ninhu, he didn't tell me it's not his money. Get Mirinu, that I should bury it. So I thought it was his money. So I didn't think. I figured he may need it for short term expenses or whatever.
She didn't know it was his money, meaning that if it's not his
meaning
money,
if she had known if she had no, if she had no, if she had known that it was a Picardin, she would have known she had to bury it. She knew that law.
She doesn't care about his son's
not money. She doesn't care about her son's money. She may figure my son is gonna need it for short term expenses. He was masked it by me, but he's probably gonna need it today or tomorrow or the next day or whatever. Therefore I didn't bury it. Had I known it was a Picardin, I would have buried it. Okay. No, let's go back to him. So fine, let's go back to the son and say in that case it was your pshia. Why didn't you tell her that it wasn't a pikadin? Omar, he can answer. On the contrary, I figured all the more so. I figured if I tell her, if I make her think it's my own money, fame is darabu, she's going to be even more careful with it. So basically, you know, as the expression goes, what we had here is a failure to communicate. He thought she'll guard it better if she thinks it's his. She figured, Abba, if it's a Picardin, I have more of a responsibility. So yeah. Okay. Bottom line, who do we make chayev? Ella Omar Rava. So Rava says the din has to be like this. Mishtaba ihu dahanu zilzi ashlamino le'imei. The original shomer, the son, has to swear that this money he taka gave to his mother. The mother will swear that money she put in a box and it was stolen. There are different Rishonim talk about this, and there's even a difference in Girsa whether it's Upater or Uptiri. No big deal. Whether it's Upater or Uptiri, is it will say he's Potter and maybe though she's Chayev, or maybe will it be Uptiri, they're both Potter. Because again, it wasn't negligence; it was just a failure to communicate.
Sure.
Well, it theory would mean they're both potter. Potter would mean that he's potter, but she would still remain chayim. Okay.
Several versions.
There's two different gusaris among Rishonim. Yeah. Okay. Another case. This is now we're off the topic of money, of guarding money. But since we talked about a couple of cases, where there was a lack of clarity what the halacha should be. So now we're going to talk about a couple of other such cases.
For that clarity?
Where there wasn't clarity and where eventually we clarified the situation. Hahu apotrupa de yasmi, the zabalo turtle yasmi, there was an apotrupus, a guardian of Yisomim. He bought an ox on behalf of the Yisomim out of the money from the estate. Umasri labkara, and he gave that ox to a cowherd to take care of it. Loi havalei kochi v'shini lamechol. This ox did not have kochi. Rashi in a few places. Rashi in some places. Rashi explains that kochi means gums. A Tosfos in those places says it doesn't mean gums. It means back teeth. Shini means front teeth. Whatever it is, it didn't have anything to eat with. Umis, and so it ended up dying. Omar Rami Bachama. So now Rami Bachama says, Heichin dainu dayoni lahaydina. Okay, how should the dayonim judge this case? Who do we say is the responsible party? Namely, Lapatrupa Zilshlim, should be said to the Apatrupas, you have to pay back the Yisomim. It's your problem because you bought a defective ox. Omar, he can answer, not my problem, I know the Bakra Mesartia. I gave it to the cowherd. Which means, so Rashi says it means the cowherd should have informed me this animal was not eating. Now, so the Ramban talks about why shouldn't he have been careful to buy a good ox to begin with? And it gives a few answers. One is you can't tell the problem until the animal eats. The apotropos himself just buys the animal and gives it right over to the cowherd. He doesn't necessarily know whether it's defective like that. Another possibility, he says, is maybe it's only something you need to be an expert. You need to be like an expert in animals, a veterinarian or whatever, to know. And the apotropos is not that. So whatever it is, yet another possibility is he saying that I gave it to the cowherd, meaning if there's anything wrong with it, I expect that by giving it to him, that implies you should look it over and see if there's anything wrong with it. And like this, he failed in his duty. He didn't tell me anything.
You can say they both failed.
No, but the point is, according to these various explanations, that apotropos didn't fail because it's not his business to know, really. It's not the kind of thing that he would easily be able to know. And another thing that Amban actually says also is it's such an unusual case that an animal shouldn't have teeth like that. The apotropos does not have to consider such an out-of-the-way possibility. Yes. Okay. Anyway, fine. Namely, the Bakra Zil Shlo. Fine.
You did that much without teeth, which...
such an animal could eat. It would have to eat a liquid diet, or it would have to be fed. You know, you'd have to mash up the food for it, or whatever.
The animal didn't have teeth.
Wait. We're gonna get to that. Yeah. What were we gonna say?
Yes. There is an animal that doesn't have teeth on the bottom or the top. Is it a
kosher animals have front teeth on the top, but not the bottom, if I remember correctly, and they have back teeth.
Right.
That's one of the differences between.
What does this not have?
So this one didn't have front teeth, and it didn't have kachi. So just on the top even, and it didn't have kachi, which again, either according to Tosfos in a number of places, kachi means back teeth, molars, or according to Rashi in a few places, kachi means gums. So whatever it is, it was unable to chew food. So it could survive on a liquid diet. If somebody would have had to mash up the food for it, whatever.
Such an animal.
Wait. Okay.
We should know about it.
Okay, hold on. Namely the Bakra Zil Shlim. Fine, should we go to the cowherd and tell him, no, you have to pay, you were careless over here that you didn't inform anybody? Omar, he can say, what's the problem? I put this ox together with all the other oxen. I gave it food. I didn't know it's not eating. So I didn't do anything out of the ordinary. They talk about, Tosfos talks about, a number of Rishonim talk about, is the apotropos considered a Shema Chinam or Shema Sachar? Is the Bakra a Shema Chinam or a Shema Sachar? Because that may make a difference. A Shema Sachar has a higher level of responsibility. Okay. Next. Okay, let's consider. The Bakra is for sure a Shema Sachar, so that's the Gemara's question. The question is really, is the apotropos maybe? Tosfos discusses the possibility, is the apotropos maybe a Shema Chinam or a Shema Sachar? The question is, Mechti Bakra Shema Sachar de Yasmihu. Fine, but let's consider the cowherd, at least, is a Shema Sachar on behalf of the Yasomim. He's taking care of the Yasomim's animal for pay. He's not doing it for free. Ibole le yuni. He should have checked into it. What do you mean? I gave it food and I didn't notice that it wasn't eating. That's not the kind of responsibility that a Shema Sachar is supposed to have. The answer is, Iikipsede de Yasmi Hachinam. You're right. If the Yasomim had ended up losing because of this, because it was their animal and it died and now they're out the money, you're right. We would make the Bakra pay and there wouldn't be any question. Rami Bachama wouldn't have any question. But the case over here is a little bit different. The lack of Seder Diyas, namely there was actually no loss of the Yasomim, because they found the original owner who the apotropos bought the animal from, the Shako Yasmi Zulimine, and the Yasomim got their money refunded by him. They told him it's a Medi Day or the apotropos, whatever. The original owner, the person who the apotropos bought it from. The person with the apotropos bought it from, they went to him, the Yasomim themselves, the apotropos, whoever it is, went to this guy, look at the mechachtos, you sold us a defective ox, and they got their money refunded. So therefore, the Yasomim are out of the picture now. Therefore, we're not talking about whether the Bakra is a Shema Sachar on behalf of the Yasomim. It doesn't matter. Okay, well, then the question is, Elaman Katoin. Fine, so then whose loss is it? Who's bringing the Din Torah over here? Yeah. The answer is, Mori Din Torah Katoin. It's actually the owner himself, the one who sold the ox to the apotropos. Is suing. He's taking the apotropos to base. Wait. He says you, the apotropos, or maybe the Bakra or whatever, should have informed me that this animal was defective.
And he should have been informed.
Wait. That's the question. Is my modin? The Gemara itself is going through this step by step. Hold on. The question is my modin. What are we supposed to inform him? Meida yada. He himself knows. And he was told that it was a defective thing and that it was a mechatos. The answer is, we're not talking about the original owner of the animal, as in he raised this animal from babyhood, the safsira. This person who the apotropos bought the animal from is a middleman. he buys from one person and sells directly to the other person. The same Rashi says it's all the same day. On the same day when the cattle market is in session, he buys from one person and resells it right away to another. So he's not the kind of person who has it in his possession long enough to know that there's any problem. So Yitzchak didn't know there was a problem until it was pointed out to him. Therefore he has a valid claim. Somebody, the apotropos or the cowherd or whatever, should have informed him at some point that this animal was defective.
The initial seller should have
informed him. Fine, maybe that too, but whatever. The initial, he may even not know. He may not even know who the initial seller was. He bought from 100 different people on that day. Yeah. Okay. So, right. Now, one second. So in that case, what's the suffix over here? Tosfos says the suffix is like this. We learned earlier in the parak, we had the case of a socher who rents, of a person rents a cow from one person and then lends it to another. We said if it dies in the possession of the shoyl, we said the Tanakama had said over there that the shoyl pays the socher once the socher swears. And Rabbi Yossi said you can't do business with somebody, you can't profit off somebody else's cow. Tax the part of the bialim or shonim. The payment goes back to the original owner. So Tosfos says over here. Here also, you can say like this. On the one hand, you could say given that the Yisoyimim have gotten their money refunded by the middle by this middleman over here, so now the middleman is the one who has a valid claim. He has a valid claim against the cowherd. He can consider the cowherd as my shomer, therefore he should be paying me. Or maybe not. Maybe not over here. Maybe the Yisoyimim are completely out of the picture. The Safsira, the middleman himself, can't be said to be in the place of the Yisoyimim. Therefore, he really has no business with the cowherd. If he brings the cowherd to Beis Din, maybe the cowherd can argue, I have no business with you. I'm not your shomer. I have no connection with you. I have a connection with the Yisoyimim and the apotropos. But they're out of the picture. That's the suffix. Does the Safsira have a valid case to bring against this bakra, against this cowherd?
The money was reimbursed in any case.
Fine, but now the Safsira himself is out that money. What do you mean, what does he lose? He had to refund the money to the assignment, and now all he has is a dead off. Where at least if he had known that this is the situation, fine, he might not have been able to salvage the animal, but at least he would have been able to chef it and have meat. Like this, it's an available, it's good for his dog food. Okay. So therefore what we do is the din is as follows. Mishtaba ihu deloy have a yada. The safsira, the middleman, swears that he didn't know, that he just bought it from one person and sold it right away to that apotropos and never had any chance to know what the situation was. Or mishalom bakra d'mei basar b'zoil. And then what we do is, on the basis of that, we make the bakra, the cowherd, pay the cheap price of meat. Meaning, Rashi says, two-thirds of the usual amount. So Rashi says this is kind of a pshara. This is kind of a compromise. Given that, again, Rashi brings over here the same thing that Tosfos brought about that Rabbi Yossi says tax the part of the Bailam or Rishonim, that since Rashi argues that according to one, so Tosfos had brought both possibilities. Rashi explains that in the end what we do is we pass in according to one of those possibilities. Since the Yisoyimim would have been able to collect from the shepherd, from the cowherd, because he's their Shema Sofer, in this case they got refunded their money by the Safsira. Now the Safsira is in their place. The cowherd is effectively now, by transference, his shoma sofer. Therefore, he has the right to take them to Beis Din. On the other hand, though, the fact of the matter is the cowherd does have a valid counter argument. It wasn't really pshia because I put it with the other oxen, etc. I didn't know there was a problem. Therefore, what we do, Rashi says, is a compromise, and we say instead of making the cowherd pay the full value, what we do is we make him give the skin to the safsira, which is worth something, as far as the meat, you make them pay two-thirds the value of the meat. That's a compromise. Tosfos says it's not a compromise. Tosfos says, when you think about it, what would have happened if the safsira had known that this animal is like this? It's not going to be able to eat. He would have had to shecht it right away. No, he would have, well, let's say he knew after he bought it. After he bought it, let's say he found out that it had this defect. He would have had to shecht it right there on the spot. But it's not the market day for meat. Necessarily, he would have had to sheft it right there on the spot, and therefore he would have had to sell it at a discount because it's not the day when most people are buying meat. So therefore, when we say that you make the bakra pay two-thirds of the value of the meat, that's actually the fair thing because that's all the safsira would have gotten for it anyway, two-thirds of the value. The Ravid brings another explanation also, which goes to what you were saying, how did this animal eat all this time? The Ravid says, in fact, when you think about it, this animal must have been a very skinny, scrawny kind of animal. Therefore, you can only get two-thirds of the price, because that's all you would get for that kind of meat anyway.
To begin with, how did he live until now? How nobody noticed he was so skinny?
They talk about, a number of Rishonim talk about, by the way, what the basis of the Shavua is over here. Is it a Shavua? A Shomer, that we're saying that the Sefsira has to swear. Do we consider him a Shomer? Is he swearing as a Shomer swears? Is he swearing maybe as a Nigzal, as the equivalent of a Nigzal, sort of, and he collects on that basis? Is it Rambam says it's only a Shavua's Hesis, et cetera? Another case. Hahu Gavre Da'achid Kshusa Gavre Chavre. There was a person who deposited Kshus for safekeeping by somebody else. Kshus is hops. You know, when they make beer, they brew beer out of, nowadays they do barley, in the time of the Gemara usually they use dates, and then they put in hops to give it a bitter flavor. What good that does, I don't know, I can't stand beer, so I don't know what the good of it is, but those who like beer, I guess, it's a plant.
Right.
Actually, the truth is there's actually two differences. There's hops, which are an actual flowering plant, and then there's something else, which is called in English, it's called cascuda or something like that, which is sort of like a parasitic plant, which grows on thorns or whatever. It seems what the Gemara is talking about over here is the second kind. Nowadays, they use the first kind in making beer. Apparently, in those times, they use the second kind. I don't know. Whatever. Anyway. So, this person deposited some of this by somebody else. Now, the Shomer himself also had a pile of this of Kshus. So one day, the Shomer tells his servant, who's in charge of doing things around his house, including brewing his beer, he tells him, Mahay Rami, take from this pile, meaning my pile of Kshus, and put some of that into the beer that we're brewing. Yeah, also Rami, of course, otherwise there wouldn't be a case. Yeah. Also Rami Meidach. So the servant ended up taking from the other pile. From the pile of the scud. Sort of Amram asks, okay, how are the Dayanim supposed to decide this case? What can we say that he is, can we make the guy chayev or not? Namely, Lidi Day Zil Shlim, should we tell the Shomer, go pay Omar? He can say, why should I have to pay? I told him, take from this pile. Not my fault if he disobeyed my instruction. Namely, no, it doesn't matter. No, the pashas, we're not talking about an Eved Knani. Sarsay just means, actually just says, Lasher al Beisay, the person in charge of his household. Or it's a sheikh or shalom, who makes his beer.
What is he, not a shamer.
No. Okay, so what the original person was, many poskim say that the original shomer must have been a shomer chinam. If he was a shomer sacher, just saying, I told him to take from that one is not enough. His responsibility would include to dafka tell the guy, take from this one and not from this one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We saw that.
Yeah. So, like this, yeah. Okay. But if he was a shomer chinam, then yeah, he doesn't have that level of responsibility. Okay. Namely, the Sarsay Zil Shlim, fine, should we tell the servant to go pay? Omar, he can answer, what's the problem? Loi Omali Mehai Rami Mehai Loi Tumi. He didn't specifically tell me, take only from this one, not from that one. I thought he's just showing me where some truth is available. I didn't realize there's a difference between one pile and another. Okay. The Gemara asks, the Ida Shah Shir Suya Levelai Aisilei. Fine, but let's say his own pile of Kshus was close by, the one of the Pekadin was further away, and the Ida Shah Shir Suya Levelai Aisilei. So suppose he knows that it should take 5 minutes to go and get from his pile of Kshus, and instead he sees that the guy is gone for 15 minutes. Before he goes, he should have known. Gali Adaita Denichalei. Doesn't that mean that he showed that he doesn't mind it? He knew, he must have known at that point that it came, not necessarily. Okay, it could be that he took extra time because of something else, but at least there's a strong possibility. Yeah, he went to the bathroom. At least he should have had reason to suspect that it came from the other pile, and therefore he should be chayav. The answer is, but Loishah, fine, we're talking about it wasn't any extra time. Yeah, two piles were in different places, but not, it wasn't any further to get, it wasn't any more significant amount of time to get to one than the other. By the way, in Shulchan Aruch, the Sneh and the Shach disagree. What about the situation if it was the other way around? What if his the case that we had, if his one was far away and the other guy's was closer?
Yeah,
one way of looking at it is same difference. If he knew in that case that it should take him 15 minutes and he took only 5, then he should know there's a problem over here and not allow it.
If it was 5, then
on the other hand, the Shach says maybe not. when his pile is closer by, what are you doing going to the further one? But if his pile is further away, he might think, the shliach himself certainly has a right to think, and maybe even the Baal HaBos himself has a right to think, you know what, the shliach certainly has a right to think, you know what, he didn't tell me I doubt it. No, actually, the shach says the other way around. If the pile belonging to the Kodin is closer by, then there's no excuse that the shliach can say, I thought that you were just telling me, yeah, I can take from whichever one I want. Why do you think he told you to go to the further one? Because the further one is his. As opposed to the case.
You still have to say without going to that one.
No, again, if he was a shemesh sacher, there's no question. You would have to say you have to go to this one, not to that one, another one, otherwise you pass. But a shemesh chinam, we're saying, as long as he said go to this one, not that one. However, the shach argues there's still a distinction because if the one from the kodim was closer by and his own was further away, and he tells him go to the further away one, then the shliach does not have an excuse to say, okay, I thought he was just telling me where there's trus available. Because you should have thought to yourself, well, if you knew that there's one closer available, and yet the guy specifically told you to go to the further one, obviously he wanted you to take from that one.
Yeah.
Where's the snail? Because there's no difference. Okay. So you might ask, so fine. Bottom line, what's the actual din tod over here? Might say to him, what loss is there after all? Okay, he used X amount of truth. Fine, he has his own pile of truth. Reimburse him using your own pile, and that's that. He gained. He used kshus from the bikkurim. He put it into his beer. Fine. He used X amount of kshus. Give him X amount of kshus to make up for it. And then we're free. What do we have a whole complicated din tod over here? Amr of Samagrid, but to have a shichra chala. The case is over here where the beer that he made went sour. It became vinegary. So therefore, the shomer is arguing, there's no reason I should have to pay the full value of this trust. I didn't get the full benefit out of it because the beer went bad. So therefore, we have to discuss, is he chayav or not? Rav Ashi, I'm a b'kisi. Rav Ashi says, here's another possibility. The kshus was bad quality. Kisi, Rashi explains, means there were thorns mixed into it. So therefore, yes, it helped somewhat with the beer, but not very much. It didn't improve the beer like it was supposed to. Therefore, Rashi says he would have rather that the guy didn't put it in lachatchila. And therefore, Mashalim made to make kisi. Therefore, he just has to pay him the value of kshus that has thorns mixed into it. Fine, you evaluate how much did it.
You knew it was going to be.
No, he didn't know, right? That was the whole point. He told the guy, take from my pile. The guy went and took from the other pile, which had thorns mixed into it. Therefore, what we're saying is, fine, you don't pay the full value of you use, let's say, a pound of the stuff. A pound of good kshus is worth $10. A pound of kshus with kisi is worth $7, let's say. So fine, all you have to pay is $7. Tosfos gives another explanation. Tosfos says in that case, then of course, what's the chiddush? So Tosfos explains that actually, because if it was bad quality kshus, why would we think you have to pay any more than the value of bad quality kshus? So Tosfos explains, first of all, because it has thorns in it, fine, you can use it for animal food. Nevertheless, we don't say pay according to the value of animal food, you pay according to the value of how much it's worth in the beer making process. Of the beer making process. Also, Tosfos has another possibility that kisi can mean a kind of kshus which has to be softened before you put it in the beer. If you don't soften it, Rabbi Hananel says, Tosfos quotes it. It's a kind of thing that needs to be softened a bit before you put it into the beer. If you don't, it doesn't do much good. So therefore, the chiddush is, even though all you would have had to do is soften it, it wouldn't have taken much to do that. Then it would have been worth the full $10 per pound. Nevertheless, you still don't have to pay that full amount.
If you didn't do it,
because the fact is it wasn't put in after it was softened. It was put in before it was softened, and therefore it didn't have its full effect. And then the one before him will explain the other way around. His own kshus was the bad stuff. The kshus of the pekodin was the good stuff. He has a valid argument. He can say, I wouldn't have cared that the good stuff has to be put in. I wouldn't have minded my own stuff being put in, and then the beer won't be such good quality. Why should I have to pay the value of the good stuff when I could have just as well used my inferior stuff? And therefore, the halacha is, in fact, he's right, and that's all he has to pay.
The value of the
inferior stuff, which was his own. Yeah.